Yeah, the church website drives me crazy.
Yeah.
Yeah, me too.
Well, there is a logic to it, that's as usual, but the logic that it has is not necessarily the logic for the rest of it. You just have to get used to whatever
course,
logic it is.
When it comes to computers, I have no logic at all.
Yeah. Let me shut this door.
Yes. Because you've been dead for 3 years.
Okay. Well, let's kind of...
It's like a security blanket. Like having a teddy bear or something.
And is your recorder on?
Yes, it is on. So today is 3rd of April. And so what we need to do is of course, recap, as always. So let's see, what do we talk? I imagine this will be our last day on the varieties of religious experience, but especially for Bonnie's sake. I would say, looking at the very, very big picture, that there are 4 themes. Four big, big themes. The first theme is the first 3 chapters. Or first 3 talks. These are lectures. And, of course, they're just on what religion is. You know, of course, that's the logical way to start. And sort of a broad brush about types of religion. And then that's followed, and these are not necessarily sequentially arranged in the work, but that's followed by what seems to me to be 2 antitheses that he works with. The first is this optimistic versus pessimistic type of religion, an optimistic one being one that at least allows a certain amount of freedom of the will, but thinks of history as being ultimately God's, God has the last say, as it were. And then the pessimistic religions being, epitomized by Al-Ghazali, who I think is the most extreme theological defender of God's absolute control of everything, which means that God is responsible for evil. Of course, that's a problem. But that's that antithesis. And then the other antithesis is actually prefigured in the 3 lectures about religion as a whole, and that's between what I have called the religion of the heart versus the religion of the head, right? Otherwise known as mystical versus philosophical. Mysticism is the name of the chapter, and philosophy is the name of the other chapter. As you know, and this has happened repeatedly, and it will happen again today, James is dispassionate observer of religion, put it that way, is much on the hard side. I mean, just observing how religious people go about their religious lives, it would seem that religion is much more a matter of the heart than of the head. He even goes so far as to say, when he's at his most pessimistic, I guess, about the head, that the head has no role at all except for what we're doing right now, which is studying religion. So in other words, if we're examining religion as psychologists, which he partly is, then that's a matter of the head. But in general, when it comes to first order as opposed to second order religious activities, the head doesn't really have a major role to play. Now, of course, that's kind of being rolled back a bit, because the last 2 lectures are really matters of the head, and it's what I've labeled Neoplatonism. That's our 4th theme. The 3rd theme, though, the one that we spent the last 2 weeks on, were, I don't know what you want to call them, just almost like appendices. This is about religion in general. And so they're about 2 phenomena that just don't really fit in any of the other categories. One is conversion and one is saintliness. So 2 weeks ago we talked about conversion. Last week we talked about saintliness. So since those are characteristics of religion, you know, if you're going to talk about the variety of religious experience, I guess you should include that. So that's what we've looked at the last 2 weeks. Now, starting today, we're going to look at the last two chapters, or what do you want to call it, the last two lectures, I guess. And one is titled Other Characteristics, and the other is titled Conclusions. So there you are. But I have titled this Neoplatonism, or James's Neoplatonism, because when it comes to his, even though he, as I said in other places, says that, well, the head doesn't really have much of a role to play in religion, which would mean that theology is really not an option. He doesn't stick to that. And when you get to the last two chapters, he's talking about what religion is and the metaphysics behind it, the metaphysics and epistemology behind it, from his point of view. And if you examine what he has to say, it's a lot like, updated Neoplatonism, I think, I mean, Plotinus is your go-to guy for the West. I mean, he's the origin of all this in the West, immense amount of influence. But this is kind of updated with from James's point of view, the latest in psychology and the whole deal. But if you discount the terminology, which is contemporary sounding terminology, and look at just what it means, he's not saying anything radically different from what Plotinus said. You could take Plotinus and sort of translate it into, Jamesian terminology, and they'd be saying something very much alike one another. So that's really, if you're going to intellectualize religion, that may be your best option, and that's kind of what James is saying here. So what I'm going to do is read you a bunch of passages, and you'll see this coming. What you'll see is, first of all, the first couple of passages, what you'll see once again is James's heart orientation, the fact that religion is so much a matter of the heart and not so much of the head. But then it'll quickly morph into the Neoplatonic sort of atmosphere until we get to the very end. So that's what's coming up. But first of all, just a couple of passages about the importance of emotion, I guess you'd say, in religion. And this is the very first, second paragraph of the first of the two lectures. The first point I will speak of is the part which the aesthetic life plays in determining one's choice of a religion. Last week. Was it last week we did the Mozart? Or was it 2 weeks ago?
It was the 20th of March.
Okay, yeah, 2 weeks ago, yeah. Well, for a lot of people, not excluding myself, I mean, that's not necessarily necessary. I don't know that any of us really accepts the theology behind dies irae, dies illa, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
What?
But we love singing it. The day of wrath, that day when the earth will, burn up into cinders and, et cetera, et cetera. But boy, is it ever fun to sing. the emotional, the aesthetic life. He says, men, I said a while ago, involuntarily intellectualize their religious experience. They need formulas just as they need fellowship and worship. I spoke, therefore, too contemptuously of the pragmatic uselessness of the famous scholastic list of attributes of the deity, for they have one use which I neglected to consider. The creeds is kind of what he's talking about here, things like the creeds. It enriches our bare piety to carry these exalted and mysterious verbal additions, just as it enriches a church to have an organ and old brasses, marbles and frescoes and stained windows. Epithets lend an atmosphere and overtones to our devotion. They are like a hymn of praise in service of glory and may sound the more sublime for being incomprehensible. So, I mean, you take something like the Nicene Creed, which is, the most famous of the I'm not talking about the Apostles' Creed. I'm talking about the creeds that came out of the church councils. But, there's a lot in there that is absolute mystery, right? Especially the divinity and unity, the divinity and humanity, I mean, of, of Jesus. It makes no, absolutely no sense, right? So it sort of has this aura of mystery and incomprehensibility and depth and all of that, profundity. And so James is saying that's an aesthetic quality. Mm-hmm. You know, the Nicene Creed, you could think of it as this is kind of a, yeah, having a highly aesthetic effect on people, not unlike D.A.C.R.I., etc. And here's a quote from a French theologian, Sabater, I guess. Never heard of him. Anyway, religion, says a liberal, this is a little bit different, but the same general idea, says a liberal French theologian, is an intercourse, a conscious and voluntary relation entered into by a soul in distress with a mysterious power upon which it feels itself to depend and upon which its fate is contingent. This intercourse with God is realized by prayer. So whereas the other quote, he was talking about the creeds, I think, and just religious discourse in general. Here he's talking about prayer. Where am I? Here it is. Prayer is religion in act. That is, prayer is real religion. It is prayer that distinguishes the religious phenomenon from such similar or neighboring phenomena as purely moral or aesthetic sentiment. Religion is nothing if it be not the vital act by which the entire mind seeks to save itself by clinging to the principle from which it draws its life. This act is prayer, by which term I understand no vain exercise of words, no mere repetition of certain sacred formulae, but the very movement itself of the soul, putting itself in a personal relation of contact with the mysterious power of which it feels the presence. It may be even before it has a name by which to call it. Wherever this interior prayer is lacking, there is no religion. Wherever, on the other hand, this prayer rises and stirs the soul, even in the absence of forms or of doctrines, we have living religion. One sees from this why natural religion, so-called, is not properly a religion. It cuts man off from prayer, right? Natural religion is philosophic religion, basically. Yes?
And what is interior prayer? What does that mean? You just read that.
I did say the interior prayer? Okay, maybe I did. Well, he just means prayer in general, but you can pray to your silently yourself. It doesn't have to be spoken, of course. Either one falls under this.
So religion without prayer is not a religion.
Yeah, that's literally what he said.
And
I know that's. I want to make that simple, not sophisticated. You know, to make it sound more profound.
No. Yes.
Doesn't seem to be distinguishing between what you do as a group and what you do.
Yes,
as a group.
I think that's a true statement. Yes, the point is, prayer is a way of linking oneself to God.
Okay.
It doesn't matter whether it's a group thing or an individual thing or a silent thing. It does not matter at all. But what doesn't work is natural theology, which is a purely philosophical approach to religion, purely intellectual approach to religion, because there's no connection there. Mm-hmm. So where was I now? It cuts man off from prayer. It leaves him and God in mutual remoteness, with no intimate commerce, no interior dialogue, no interchange, no action of God in man, no return of man to God. At bottom, this pretended religion is only a philosophy, which is true. Of course.
But you know what? So, we've talked about this before, Don, but you can have religion all through philosophy where you can believe in all these things about a deity,
mm-hmm.
but not that the deity is listening to your prayers,
mm-hmm.
or arguments or whatever,
mm-hmm.
right? Like in the case of the Islamic stuff you talk about, you're not praying, asking for Allah to change his mind.
Oh, because God's mind's already made up, you mean?
Yeah.
Uh-huh.
Or
the
other arguments, you're just a trifle, why would God, manipulate your life,
uh-huh.
right? But you can still believe in all the power of God, et cetera, without belief in prayer.
that's and this guy is saying that as well. He's just saying that if that's the case, it's just not really religion.
Okay, that just doesn't strike.
Well, okay, yeah, well, okay, well, let's say maybe two types of religion. How's that? One that's a more that's belief based or something like that, and then another one that is more
intense.
What
degree or intensity?
Yeah, something like that, or more. Devotion based, maybe. I don't know exactly.
You know, John, where would the Unitarians fit?
Oh, you know, they would probably fit as a philosophy, as I understand Unitarianism. It seems.
Yeah, I can't disagree.
Yeah, it was so funny when I was in high school. You know, this is back at the very beginnings of AP classes. I think it was very, very novel back when I was in high school, and there was only one AP class in the whole school. I wasn't in the AP. Everybody in the AP class was either Jewish or Unitarian.
Wow.
I don't know what that says, but that's a fact.
So if I'm doing a rain dance, you know, I'm a Native American doing my thing, trying to get some rain to fall.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that religion?
Yeah. I would think so.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Because you would consider that a prayer.
Yeah, so of sorts, yes. You know, there is a link there between you and heaven. Yeah.
Okay.
But if you're a, you know, Native American theologian just spouting off words about it, that's nothing but a philosophy, right? So at bottom, this pretended religion only philosophy born at epochs of rationalism, of critical investigations, it never was anything but an abstraction. An artificial and dead creation. It reveals to its examiner hardly one of the characters proper to religion. So, yeah, he's made his point. So, in both cases, both with the first one, which had to do with the creeds and religious language, and then the second one having to do with prayer, in both cases, the emphasis, of course, is on the heart, right? I mean, it's the aesthetic value in the creeds, and in the case of prayer, it's not an intellectual kind of thing. It's maybe using words, but that's as far as it gets into the intellectual side of things, you know. So yes, that's simply a confirmation of what we have seen in abundance in William James, and that is that, as I said, religion is mostly a matter of emotion for him. As a psychologist, that's what he observes. Now, but at the very end of this lecture, the other characteristics lecture, we start peeking open the door to Neoplatonism, which will be the most of what, you can see how many little things I got in here, most of what he has to say in the lecture title conclusions. But anyway, to kind of open the door, when in addition to these phenomena of inspiration, we take religious mysticism into account, when we recall the striking and sudden unifications of a discordant self, which we saw in conversion, and when we review the extravagant obsessions of tenderness, I'm sorry, yeah, that's right, extravagant obsessions of tenderness, purity, and self-severity met with in saintliness, we cannot, I think, avoid the conclusion that in religion we have a department of human nature with unusually close relations to the transmarginal or subliminal region. So here's how this is kind of the nexus, this is the link between the emotion, what he's just been talking about, but the emotional side of religion and the Neoplatonic explanation of the emotional side of it. So when we look at all this evidence, you know, how the aesthetic part of the creeds, the prayer coming from the heart and all that sort of thing, and when we examine it, we see the importance of what he said calls the, what was it again? The transmarginal or subliminal region of the brain, basically, of consciousness. Okay, let's go on. Let's distinguish, he says, call it by any name you please, to distinguish it from the level of full sunlit consciousness. Call it this latter the A region of personality, if you care to, and call the other the B region. So the one that the region that we're all engaged in right now is the B region. That's our fully conscious region, replete with verbal expressions and logic and deductive reasoning, the whole deal, right? That's the B region. The A region is, it's like the ocean. Near the surface, if you're underwater and you're near the surface of the ocean, it's suffused with light, right? The light penetrates the water to the depth of, what, 20 feet or something like that, maybe. But then, at some point, you cross a threshold, and it just becomes dark. That's the A region. The B region is the light-filled region. So that's what he means here.
Is he talking about actual physical regions of the brain, or just regions?
I think he's talking about experience, or the lack thereof. I mean, the A region we don't even experience, right? But you could translate it. We know a lot more. Not that we know that much about the brain, but we know more about it than would have been known 100 years earlier, right? Or more than 100 years ago. So you could say maybe that the B region is the left brain. That's the conscious verbal side of our brain, and the A region is the right brain and other parts too. I mean, you could translate it into brain language, but he's thinking of it more in terms of Freudian psychology, probably.
Tom, could I borrow your jacket?
Sure.
I am freezing. It's so cold in
here. Yeah, there's a breeze on this side.
Yeah.
Well, that's why I moved.
Our air exchange, I guess.
It's not much better over here.
Yeah, another row back.
Yeah. The B region is obviously the larger part of each of us. For it is the abode of everything that is latent and the reservoir of everything that passes unrecorded and unobserved. What? Oh, wait a minute now, the A region. Wait a minute. The A region, well, which is which? I thought I had it right. Maybe I'm wrong. Okay, the word subliminal, if the word subliminal is offensive to any of you, blah, 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 call it by any other name you please to distinguish it from the level of full sunlit consciousness. Call this latter. Yeah, I was right. Oh, I had it backwards. I'm sorry. I misread. Call this latter the sunlit consciousness, the A region. Okay.
That makes more sense. Okay. He likes that better, so it should be A.
Okay. I had it backwards. I'm sorry. And then the mysterious dark is the B region. Okay, now we got it. The B region, then, is obviously the larger part of each of us. For it is the abode of everything that is latent and the reservoir of everything that passes unrecorded and unobserved. Got it right. It contains, for example, such things as all our momentary inactive memories, and it harbors the springs of all our obscurely motivated passions, impulses, likes, dislikes, and prejudices. Our intuitions, hypotheses, fancies, superstitions, persuasions, convictions, and in general, all our non-rational operations come from it. It is the source of our dreams, and apparently they may return to it. In it arises whatever mystical experiences we may have, and all our automatisms, sensory or motor, our life in hypnotic and hypnoid conditions, if we are subject to such conditions, and our delusions, fixed ideas, and hysterical accidents, if we are hysteric subjects, our supranormal cognitions, if such there be, and if we are telepathic subjects. As you know, that back in his day, I don't know anymore, but there was a lot of interest in things like telepathy and stuff like that. He was part of all that. It is also the fountainhead of much that feeds our religion, the B region. In persons deep in the religious life, as we have now abundantly seen, and this is my conclusion, the door to this region seems unusually wide open. At any rate, experiences making their entrance through that door have had emphatic influence in shaping religious history. So the great prophets say, are B region type people. They're people that had a unusually, I don't know, active B region, which is somehow, as you'll see, linked with God, and somehow occasionally that kind of erupts into the into the sunlit A region, so you become aware of thus saith the Lord, that sort of thing, right?
Gosh, I thought maybe he was arguing that it's in B because it doesn't survive rational scrutiny.
No. See,
I'm appealing to your subconscious, and don't try to logically argue.
This is his Neoplatonism, right? Well, look. here it is. Is this it? Well, actually, it's not very well drawn, is it?
You mean your McDonald's logo there? I'm not sure what you were getting at.
Yes, you did see my...
One of these Subway, McDonald's, and something.
I'm going to have to come in here with something a little more than an eraser. But anyway, this is my usual picture of Plotinus, right? This is matter, sensible matter.
Matter.
See if this works better. Worse.
Oh, hi.
Hey.
This is no good.
You should probably not put it back on the...
I know, but I don't see a trash can anymore over there. But I tell you what, Patty. You can take charge of that one. And I'm going to look.
We need to get you a blackboard and some chalk.
this is okay.
How long has it been since you've heard this, that squeaking of chalk on a blackboard?
Oh, God. Can we please not?
Let's try this
fingernail. I'm sure I'd go on YouTube and find it.
Okay, that says matter. For Plotinus, matter in Plotinus is like Aristotelian prime matter, has no attributes whatsoever. But it's at the limit of emanation, right? And this is the one up here, right? And there's the dividing line here, right? This is soul. And individual souls are simply outgrowths of soul. And this is nous. There's no English word that really translates it. Can be translated mind, spirit, it's like Geist in German. And individual nooses are outgrowths of nous, okay? But the reason I put this up is because this is what James is calling the A region, and this is what he's calling the B region. Because soul is our normal, this is Plotinus' word for our normal conscious life. And that's what James calls the A region. Nous is something deeper than that. It's really not normally a part of our consciousness. And that's what James is calling the B region. See, so we're talking about the last two lectures of varieties of religious experience, where he began by talking about the fact that religion is more of the matter of the heart than of the head, and then this is a transitional paragraph I read where he's kind of opening up the or transiting to the explanation of the phenomena, the emotional phenomena that are so characteristic of religion, and he distinguishes the A region and the B region of our consciousness, where the B region is really the subconscious, and the A region is the conscious. And all I'm saying is, when you came into the room, I was drawing this picture, all I'm saying is, this is an updated version of Plotinus. Nous, in Plotinus, is not part of our normal consciousness. Therefore, it'd be what James is calling the B region. Psuche, soul, is our normal consciousness. That's what James calls the A region. So, I mean, the more things change, the more they remain the same, right? I mean, we have these fundamental ideas that characterize religious philosophy for centuries in the West. And, you know, they get the terminology changes, but the basic philosophic commitments remain the same because it works. Plotinus is the most underrated philosopher who's ever lived, by the way. I think I said that about 10 times, or maybe 20, or maybe 21. But and the most overrated philosopher is Hegel.
Don't get grumpy now.
Well, I'm teaching Hegel at Ollie. I'll be so glad we're done. But I don't tell them that. Don't tell them I said that.
They probably can tell.
I try to mask it, but probably I'm not very successful. I try to look at it positively. But boy, what a pompous... Yes?
Isn't there a problem with the drawing, though? Isn't the subconscious supposed to be bigger than the...
Oh, well, yeah, James does say the B region is bigger, true. Yeah, right. But this is the way I always draw Plotinus.
Right.
But my point is... What's of interest here is, if you were to ask Plotinus, which part of this is our normal consciousness?
Mm-hmm.
It's here.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So. Okay. Now going on to conclusions. This is the last lecture, and this one is almost totally devoted to fleshing out what the last couple paragraphs of the previous one had opened the door to. The world of our experience consists at all times of two parts, an objective and a subjective part, of which the former may be incalculably more extensive than the latter, and yet the latter can never be omitted or suppressed. The objective part is the sum total of whatsoever at any given time we may be thinking of. The subjective part is the inner state in which the thinking comes to pass. What we think of may be enormous, the cosmic times and spaces, for example, whereas the inner state may be the most fugitive and paltry activity of mind, yet the cosmic objects, so far as the experience yields them, are but ideal pictures of something whose existence we do not inwardly possess, but only point at outwardly. While the inner state is our very experience itself, its reality and that of our experience are one. A conscious field plus its object is as felt or thought of, plus an attitude towards the object, plus the sense of the self to whom the attitude belongs. Such a concrete bit of personal experience may be small, but it is a solid bit as long as it lasts, not hollow, not a mere abstract element of experience such as the object is when taken all alone. It is a full fact, even though it be an insignificant fact. It is of the kind to which all realities whatsoever must belong. The motor currents of the world run through the like of it. It is on the line connecting real events with real events. That unshareable feeling which each one of us has of the pinch of his individual destiny as he privately feels it rolling out on fortune's wheel may be disparaged for its egotism, but and may be sneered at as unscientific, but it is the one thing that fills up the measure of our concrete actuality. And any would-be existent that should lack such a feeling or its analog would be a piece of reality only half made up. So in other words, he's talking about inner experience here, right? I mean, it's not the same antithesis as before. He says, okay, well, there's what we're thinking of, the object out there. I could be thinking of the universe, for all I know. I could be thinking of that. But then there's the subjective side of that thought, right, which has all sorts of attributes connected with it. There's the thinking itself of the object. There are the emotional attitudes that connect to our thinking of the object. For example, I might be overwhelmed with awe at thinking of the universe, you know. Well, that's an emotional response, but that's part of the subjective side, right? And then there's the I, the ego, the person, the self behind it, we're always vaguely aware of in any of our experiences. In other words, this subjective side of consciousness has a lot of details to it. So there's the object that we're thinking of, and then there's the complex inner experience that we all have, even when we're thinking of something intellectually, you know. If this be true, it is absurd for science to say that the egotistic elements of experience should be suppressed. The axis of reality runs solely through the egotistic places. They are strung upon it like so many beads. To describe the world with all the various feelings of the individual pinch of destiny, all the various spiritual attitudes left out from the description, they being as describable as anything else, would be something like offering a printed bill of fare as the equivalent for a solid meal. Religion makes no such blunder. The individual's religion may be egotistic, and those private realities which it keeps in touch with may be narrow enough, but at any rate, it always remains infinitely less hollow and abstract as far as it goes than a science which prides itself on taking no account of anything private at all. A bill of fare with one real raisin on it instead of the word raisin, and with one real egg instead of the word egg, might be an inadequate meal, but it would at least be a commencement of reality. So, you know, I mean, he's obviously making a contrast here between science, which of course aims at total objectivity, and that which is totally in the public sphere, right? And not taking into account the observer or the observer's feelings or even the observer's thoughts while the observer is observing, or the observer's ego self, I, that's under, you know, all that other stuff, you know. Science is in the realm of the public, but religion is not. Religion is more a matter of inner experience. I think he's right on that. You know what I'm going to do next year? What we're going to do next year? I've had this idea. Hope it works out. Next year, I thought about inviting various people, various members of our congregation, and this would have to be very non-threatening. Uh-huh. We all have to agree ahead of time. This has got to be non-threatening. To come in here and tell us why they're Christian. Mm-hmm. You know, why do you come to church? Mm-hmm. And I'm willing to hear anything. I mean, maybe somebody would say, well, I just enjoy the beauty of it or something. Non-theological. Or maybe I want to, you know, have my children learn ethical behavior. Or, you know. Well, if you were to ask me, so I may do it too, you know, I guess it would only be fair if I did. I really think that I'm really... The one good thing about Hegel...
except that he's dead.
Right? No more.
That happens
he's
good too. Yeah.
His pen is
That's
quiet.
Right. You're right. The first of two good things about Hegel is that... is that he was a phenomenologist. And he gives it the name. You know, if you read my book, I don't know if you have or not, or any of you, but I talk about three epistemological positions. Usually, if you take philosophy 101, you hear about rationalism versus empiricism. The rationalist being the one, a mathematical kind of, like Descartes, a mathematical kind of mind, Plato. An empiricist being like Aristotle, somebody who goes out and looks at the world and that sort of thing. So this constant struggle between those two. My contention is that there are really three. There's the phenomenological, what Hegel calls phenomenology, but it goes way back to ancient India. That's why I learned Sanskrit, because I'm interested in Indian thought. Before Plotinus, you don't find it in the West, but you find it way, way on back in India. That seems to be a third and distinct approach to knowledge, this whole idea of one's inner experience. I cannot buy, although you hear pop psychologists claiming that the self is an illusion. Say, I have never heard a non-question begging argument for that proposition, or that there is no, you know, there's no such thing as inner, well, you can't say there's no such thing as inner experience, I guess, but that there's anything behind it, that it's all just reducible to brain matter. I can't buy that. I've never been persuaded by the arguments. So that's kind of what James is saying too. Is that region is the region that we link to religion. There have been attempts, of course, to make God like a scientific postulate, right? I mean, like the cosmological argument for God's existence, for example. Everything needs a cause, blah blah blah, out there in the world. I mean, but there can't be an infinite chain of causes. There's got to be a first link in the chain. That would be God, blah blah blah. Thomas Aquinas, five ways, and all that. I think that has been demolished by criticisms. But what has not been demolished, and I have never seen a way of anything persuading me that it could be demolished, is there's this idea of inner experience, and indeed that's where religion seems to come from. There seems to be something there. That's a little quick statement is what I would say if I were put in the hot seat. Yeah.
Regarding the public part of religion, right, where he's... Yeah. what you described. It's more of a private thing.
Well,
his model.
Yeah, yeah. Well, that's where it comes from. Now, of course, you can express it to other people.
Well, what I'm getting at is rigid expectations in a religion about how you will actually believe and act.
Mm.
Let's just take Islam again.
Right, right.
You're supposed to pray X number of
times
a day.
Yeah.
You're supposed to do it this way.
Iron Man.
All this very rigid.
True.
Regardless of what your own inner feelings about how you want to pray are, right?
Uh-huh.
You know, similarly, you know, you go to church or back in time, you're supposed to, you know, a service is done this way, Don.
True.
You know, you better get with the program,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
And so what does he think? What
well,
do you think?
That's purely external.
But it can be very important to try to force you to be a certain way.
That may not be healthy. On the other hand, you know, if you're talking about, for example, how about the Latin Mass? I have this guy in class, yeah, Adrian. I think he's Jewish, but he knows a heck of a lot about Catholicism.
Well, he knows a lot about
a lot of things.
Stuff.
That's true. That's true. But I mean, he pops up the other day. He was quoting from some Catholic publication about what I'm going to talk about. And I'm like, how do you know about all that? He knows more about than I do. But, you know, the present pope has been very...
anti-Latin.
Exactly.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, very anti-Latin. And, of course, there's a hardcore of people who love the Latin Mass. And my two Jewish people in class who know a lot more about it than I do, they love the Latin Mass, too. You know, Bob is the other one. He sings over at St. Matthew's.
Cathedral?
Yeah,
oh,
where Paul
okay.
Hardy is, our former organist. Well, anyway, but that fits right into James's thing, right? The first thing I read about the aesthetic.
Aesthetic.
Yeah.
The ritual.
Yeah. Oh. And, of course, the argument on the other side is, well, you can't, you know, you don't speak that language anymore. It's a bunch of mumbo-jumbo. And the response is,
So what?
Exactly. That's not the point. You know? And anyway, it's not hard Latin. And if you hear the same thing for years, Sunday after Sunday, and you're told what it means, then you know what it means.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
You know?
Yeah, that's, you know, that's what when you were singing the...
yeah, the Dies Irae, et cetera,
et cetera. You know, I said to him after, I wish they would have the English words there.
Uh-huh. Oh, and the Latin.
And the Latin.
Yeah.
But didn't they? Didn't they have...
No, I think they just had the English, right?
I think it was the English.
Yeah.
It was the same because it
does elevate
mm-hmm.
spirit.
I know it.
It does. It does elevate the spirit. You know, even if you say, for example, in Germany, when they're in the Senate, sometimes they start to argue in Latin.
Uh-huh.
At least they used to.
Right, I got that.
But it was like a way to say, wait a second, we can elevate this to
a
different level.
Yeah. There is something very dignified sounding about Latin to us. Now, maybe back in Cicero's day, I don't know, but to us, it has this.
There's a
aura.
Elevated kind of.
The aura,
To
make
and they still they do the German school at least when my kids were there.
Uh-huh.
We did. They did have Latin.
Well, that was a while
Latin
ago, though.
Was. Well,
yeah.
Well, it was not long ago. My kids are, you know, 50,
mm-hmm.
40, and so on.
Mm-hmm.
And they had to, and they were to compete with. The people at St. Alban.
Oh, I see.
Oh, yeah, they had that competition going.
Right,
so it was like a bring it up to a different.
Yeah, level.
But to make a pop culture reference, I mean, I understood five words out of Dos Origitos the first time I heard it when watching Encanto, but it still brought me to tears.
And
there's a certain element of it just being foreign.
Yeah.
And you know, when you're not understanding the words, all you have to go on is tone and the expressiveness, right?
Uh-huh, uh-huh.
And all those other elements that are part of speech and communication that are not the rational meanings of the words.
Yeah. Isn't that interesting?
You know, or if you say read past like King James or some sophisticated Bible passages, and then maybe you pull out your daughter's, at least when she was younger, the Bible story is there and the language is really simplified.
Mm-hmm.
Right? You may not get the same feeling out of it for this simple language.
Right.
Or otherwise where it's been, I hate to say dumb, simplified.
Yeah.
Versus,
well,
say,
the
beautiful language of King James or something gives you that extra kick.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, you know, interestingly, I mean, of course, that's a very common phenomenon. I remember, you know, when the Akkadians took over, who were Semitic speakers, took over Mesopotamia and supplanted the old Sumerians, and Sumerian language died out, it was, guess what? It was still used in liturgies. And I'm sure it had the same effect on them, you know? They didn't understand a word of it, but it had the kind of elevated sound to it. So it's not just Latin. I mean, you know, it seems to be a sort of universal phenomenon.
Can I ask one more, more thing about it? It came to mind when we were talking about the inner experience, this line, I think it's Wordsworth, birth is a sleep and a forgetting, as if you know everything about God, you've been up there, but when you're born, you don't, you know, you forget the details.
Right.
He doesn't think that could be where Plotinus.
That reminds me of Plato, right? You know, the idea of recollection. Learning is recalling what you saw in between incarnations. But for Plotinus, or for James too, this region here, or otherwise known as the B region, maybe I should have drawn it upside down, maybe that would somehow, you know, but anyway, that's a sort of ongoing kind of thing. So it's not as I saw it at one point and then I forgot it and then I have to recollect it or whatever. It's an ongoing sort of two-way communication between me and God. You know, that's the idea, or the one. Well, I tell you what, this is. We're kind of out of time. I have several more passages to read, but that's okay. I really just got the. I think all I read was the very first one. Under conclusions, I mean. So we'll have to pick up. This is good. We'll simply pick up with this again next time. Take two. What we're doing? Don't worry. What we're doing is we'll finish this, and then we're going to do a pluralistic universe, which in my notes I have also titled Neoplatonism. But that will be much quicker. I mean, maybe 1 week or at most two, I would think. We'll probably be sick of Neoplatonism by then. I don't know. But anyway, so that will leave all of May and maybe a little bit of April, you know. And we'll do Wittgenstein, partly because Wittgenstein was somewhat influenced by William James, interestingly enough.
So I guess, but my question about being all the rituals and stuff, yeah. James would be saying, you know, go along, do what you need to, but because that doesn't really affect your inner feeling, right? Like if you're supposed to pray five times a day, and everybody is watching to make sure you're doing it right, but that's a minor inconvenience.
I think probably so.
That doesn't get in the way of your relationship.
Yeah, I think I think that's a fair statement. Okay. So you might as well. It's not that big of a deal. But it's just the external trappings.
Okay.
Yeah, that's not what's important. Yeah. Well, with that profound observation, we'll break up for today and get together again next week. See you, Bonnie.
Thanks, John. Thanks for still doing Zoom.
Yeah, sure.
This thing is dead.
Oh yeah, I know that goes in the trash.
Did you make these?
No, I didn't. I wish I could see. I was done.